is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Alice Lichtenstein, who has a new book called Lost. Hi, Alice. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
And I should say Lost is a novel for anyone who may not have run across it yet. I think the book came out in March. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, I love this book. I thought it was very interesting, you know, kind of grabbed me right away. Not all books do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, kind of made it, I made a smooth read all the way through it, which is also unusual for me because I often get interrupted and stop along the way.
Mm.
But I thought, you know, and I don't want to give away a story to people who have not read the book necessarily, but it's a book that centers on a character named Christopher, who's an architect who's now has dementia to an advanced state. He's being taken care of by his younger wife. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what inspired you to write this story.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for your very kind words about Lost. This story actually did not begin in my mind with Susan and Christopher. It began with Corey, who's a character you haven't mentioned yet, who is a really nearly mute 11-year-old boy. And an actual event happened in my hometown of Oneonta, at least 10 years ago, probably even a little longer. A boy unwittingly, accidentally, set fire to his family home, and his brother was killed in the fire. And the survivor, this young boy, and his parents, and another child, I believe. And that boy haunted me for a long time. I thought about him in those sort of meditative moments, wondering primarily, you know, how was he going to go on with his life? How were his parents going to go on with theirs? What was their relationship going to be like after such a tragic event? And, of course, how extraordinary that one minor accident could cause really the complete transformation of a life. So that boy was with me for a long time, and his voice suddenly was finally released in me. I have to put it that way because that's the way I experienced it. Really, years of waiting for him to speak, and then finally the words starting to flow, and it came about sort of a wonderful afternoon where a dear friend of mine, poet Sue Standing, was visiting from Cambridge, and we decided to do sort of a mini writing retreat, just sort of hanging out was our retreat. Sue had just taken a mixed media workshop at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and they had this sort of interesting prompt. Every week the class would come up with day of blank, and then the class would decide, you know, day of pink, day of clouds, day of fear, day of anything. And then the class went off for the week and created multimedia art to express that, inspired by that prompt. And I thought that sounded really great. I'm actually usually a writer who resists prompts. I generally don't like writing in a very, you know, tight time frame or anything like that. But there was something in that idea. It had enough sort of abstraction to it, enough open space to it that I thought, oh, this could be really cool. So Sue said, how about Day of Fire? And it just went bingo. I went, yes, Day of Fire. And
so
sat
down.
That was
like an inspiration.
Yeah.
Now you connected that notion of fire back to the boy.
Yes, yes. I knew this was his chance to speak. I knew this is when I just knew the voice was going to come.
Right. So you actually, you didn't map out a book You know, it wasn't a, I mean, as some writers do a story, you know, you write, map it out. This was like...
Far from it.
Right, one character who starts an entire novel.
Yes, yes.
And the character, in fact, is not, it doesn't end up, I mean, he is obviously tightly interwoven
yes.
with the story, which, again, I don't want to give away.
Yes.
You keep multiple characters' stories
yes.
afloat through the novel. You've got the perspective of Corey, that boy.
Yes.
You have Jeff, who is the local, let's say, emergency services guy who
yes.
would be called in when someone's lost, I guess a tracker or something like that. And you have Susan, who's the wife of Christopher. Those are really the main characters, these three
yes.
people. And what I thought was interesting is I read the book and I started thinking about it. Of course, they're all lost.
Yes.
It's not that, you know, Christopher actually mm-hmm. isn't really lost.
Mm-hmm.
It's everybody else who's lost.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought that was really interesting
mm-hmm.
how you, and of course, and I did, there were some things in the way the story unfolded that were surprising. You know, I expected throughout that Susan, the wife of Christopher, would fall in love with Jeff, the tracker.
Don't think it didn't pass through my mind, but
you know. Well, I'm sure you know. It's hard to resist that in some ways.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really good that she didn't,
yes.
because that would then make it more, situational comedy,
exactly.
than or romance or something. You know, and I don't mean
yeah.
romance in a bad way, but just that it would falter the truth of the novel. I
exactly.
think. But so as you, as the story, well, how did you come to the characters of Susan and Christopher? Because I think they are
yes.
Complicated.
Yes. Well, so there I was thinking that I was writing possibly a novel, possibly just a long story about Corey.
The fire starter.
The fire starter. But it just, though I worked on it for a long time, it just somehow didn't have enough, I don't know exactly what you would call it, but somehow the narrative wasn't forming beyond what it was. And then a funny thing happened. I stepped out of my house backyard and was practically blown over by a combination of sound and fury. No, the motion, whirring of helicopter blades. And I looked up, and sure enough, there was one of those gigantic search and rescue helicopters, which if you've ever seen one, they put you in a state of panic just about. They're so, of course, any helicopter is large, but they fly very low because they're looking for someone with infrared thermo imaging technology, as it turns out. And I thought, oh my God, you know, something terrible has happened. So I went back into the house and turned on the radio to a local station, and sure enough, they were talking about, and I should mention that it was in fact a very cold January morning, and when I say cold, I mean, you know, below zero in upstate New York. And sure enough, and a man suffering from some form of dementia had wandered off from his home and was lost. My gut feeling was, and they were I should mention they were talking about, you know, bringing in this department and the volunteer fire department and the various places. And I thought, why can't we just, you know, why can't there just be an all-out bulletin, you know, citizens, you know, take to the woods, let's look for this guy, let's find him. And it just seemed to me that, you know, in a town of 20,000, we could find this guy if we all went out looking for him. I subsequently did some research that pointed out that's not the way you find lost people. But it was very frustrating. I felt like as though I just needed to be out there looking for this man. And then in real life, the drama did unfold over the course of a weekend. And it had a tragic outcome. So I didn't immediately think, oh, I need to write about this man or his wife. But again, as it turned out, through some very minor, and I don't even remember in the real story what the lack of attention was, but let's say a door was left unlocked or something like that, the surviving spouse had her life was again so completely transformed by this minor act of inattention or lack of awareness. So I, again, you know, she started to live in my imagination, and I didn't want to know anything, frankly, about the real people, though I live in a small enough town that if I had gone off after that information, I could have found out more of the facts of who they were. But
it's fiction.
But it's fiction, and I you know, that's fiction. Writers avoid wanting to know some of those kinds of things, you know.
Yeah.
So, but again, she lived with me, and I kept wondering, how is she surviving? What is her story? Why is she here? You know, I had a sense that she was an outsider. And there I was working on Corey. It wasn't working as a novel. And all of a sudden, I started to see that their lives were going to intersect. I couldn't even figure out exactly how they were going to intersect, but I knew they were going to intersect. And they did. And then, of course, I'm someone who works. I work, generally speaking, starting with voice, and I give myself complete permission to explore until, you know, at a certain point. I have to do some research, but I have actually, whether or not this is true, I have a memory of hearing Ishiguro, the novelist, talking about writing Remains of the Day, which perhaps your listeners know. It's from the point of view of a English butler in, I guess, post-World War II. And it has every single detail of being an English butler, you know, how you serve and how you organize a household and just everything about it. And the interviewer was saying, well, you know, you must have done a tremendous amount of research to understand this life. And Ishiguro said, you know, happily, nope, I just imagine things. I don't worry about those things.
Right. Well,
and I just love that. And I sort of do this. I mean, I'll tell you the story of how I end up researching. But I love to just go as far as I can imagining, and just some intuitive sense of what is what. And then it's kind of fun to go back and say, you know, where things hit the mark and where they didn't. But for the most part, and I think a lot of writers have this experience, that when you're very deeply in the groove, you know, in the flow of writing your character, the things that you make up turn out to be true. It's very odd, but
well,
sort of that gauge.
Right. I mean, there's something about the imagination that allows you to tap into knowledge, whether that's a kind of, you know, as some people would say, there is a place where those things live, and that, you know, if you can enter that state of being, you can connect to those things.
Yeah.
Those are what, you know, that it's what the imagination is really about. There's some sort of mystery there, and if we really understood it, we'd probably kill it.
Exactly.
Because you try to make it, I mean, people do try to make it into a product, but
exactly.
There is, you know, it's art. It doesn't necessarily work that way.
And then I should say, because, of course, a natural question would be, is there anyone in your family who suffered from Alzheimer's or dementia? And I haven't actually had the direct experience of being a caretaker of someone who's suffering from dementia. My beloved maternal grandmother, in the last 10 years of her life, suffered from some form of dementia, but probably one that was caused by strokes. But I did have one of my first jobs after graduating from college was working in a 500-bed nursing home, and I had quite an astonishing, amazing job of I was there to teach poetry. Seems amazing in this day and age, but I was actually hired full time to teach writing workshops, and that expanded to teaching Shakespeare in large print and recorder lessons and music appreciation and just about anything I knew, even the smallest amount about, I offered as a class. But the nursing home was organized by floor in terms of mental competence, I guess you would say. And the top floor was the floor in which all of the residents were experiencing a very severe dementia. In those days, and this is now the early 80s, relatively little was known about dementia. There was something called reversible senility, so stimulation was considered to be very important in stimulating the brain and reversing some of the, quote, senile, you know, unquote, effects. But that actually was my first experience of working or trying to work with people who really were suffering from a more advanced form of dementia, probably Alzheimer's, although Alzheimer's really isn't generally given a definitive diagnosis unless there's been an autopsy. And it was such a different realm. I mean, it was really something so other, and there I was trying to, at some level, try to connect, trying to understand. But it was, frankly, a deep mystery to me. And I think, as a writer, of course, you know, you really are. It's the mysteries that that trouble you, that keep you awake at night, that make you want to understand and try to understand as deeply as you can through. In my case, it's always been through characters, through voice, through trying to be in the skin of whatever the experience is, whatever
well,
the human experience
and
is.
Of course, in Lost, I was interested, you know, that the character Christopher, you gave him a very specific diagnosis, you know, somewhat unusual, a kind of rare form, which I think maybe acted more quickly, and so his dementia occurred very rapidly compared to some, so that Susan, you're, you know, the woman who's married to him, he's 69, she's about 57. So
that's right.
She is at a stage, you know, of being, you know, fairly, you know, unlike some people who age, you know, when you're the same age, the spouse who has care of the very ill person can't really take care
that's
of
them. That's right.
But she is young enough to be able to take care of him. And of course, this horrible, painful challenge that she has to go through, which I think you, even though you may not have had that experience, I think for people who have had the occasion to take care of someone who has dementia or Alzheimer's, I think your portrait of her was very evocative.
Well, thank you. And of course, I'm a mother, and I do think that, you know, the role of caretaker, whether or not you're man or woman, of course, like being a parent, but certainly when children are young, particularly for the mother, I would say, of that sort of eroding of the boundaries of self and other. And what, you know, basically it comes down to basically a spiritual practice, as I see it, that, you know, how do you give without having completely depleted your own sense of self. You know, what is appropriate loss of self, and then
I think to imagine that as the parent, because the child grows to become a person, and then you sort of, it's like you've built the ship and you launch the ship out
that's
into
right.
the ocean. Whereas when you're the caretaker of an older person, there is no shipbuilding going on.
That's right.
And you're completely drained by the needs of the person. And of course, the tricky thing about dementia and all of the its associated diseases is that the person who is left to care for, you know, you can see the other person for what they were, but they're not there anymore.
That's right.
And you have this continuing sense of loss rather than of you know, I know when you raise children, as I've done, as you do, you know, the child goes off, you do have that feeling of loss because your child is gone, they're grown up, but it's much different, I think.
Yes,
you know,
I agree. And Susan makes some somewhat, as she sees it herself, foolhardy and impulsive decisions. I mean, she, for instance, rather than stay in her academic community. She's a professor, and her husband's a very successful architect, and they have been living in Princeton, New Jersey, with academic friends and probably artist friends and so on. She has watched the way in which her friends, and there's no evil intent or anything like that, but they're growing discomfort with Christopher as this altered person. And she sees, and for her it's particularly, sees suffering of his trying to keep up appearances, that he's who he was. And so she decides that the best thing is for them to, you know, pick up stakes and move to a place where they're basically in isolation. And,
right. And Rich, clearly, I think she's right that, I mean, of course, this is, again, it's a novel, so you have some license there, but in practical terms, she's right that it was a terrible decision. But, of course, it allows your novel to occur.
And I appreciate her doing it for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, if she hadn't picked up stakes. And you did, I do want to talk a little bit about the environment where the story takes place, because clearly you've inhabited that place.
Yes.
You know, there's a, I think you have a really strong sense of the geography and the feeling of winter. You know, the cover of the book I thought was great, by the way. Whoever did the cover.
They did such a beautiful design. Yes.
Oh, it's terrific. And it evokes the book. And that's really, you know, that's a difficult thing to do with a book cover without falling into triteness.
Exactly.
You know, with, you don't want the cover to tell the entire story in some literal way. But you talked a lot about snow and about the nature of, you know, tracks in the snow.
Yes.
I mean, because it's all part of the place and, you know, all of these guys who are searching for Christopher, who's lost. And then you have Jeff, who's, you know, a kind of damaged character, which, you know, we may not have time to talk about him in more detail, but he's in the woods, he's actually the bridge between the searchers and Susan. And, you know, you have this really strong feeling about, you know, the sense of the cold and how brutal that is in this particular day or two when the search is going on. You know, the pulp, I mean, you live in a place which is fairly chilly, so you know that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty cold.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe somebody reading this novel in California just is going to have to go with you on it because they don't know. But you know, that I thought was a very strong, this sort of feeling of bitter cold.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm very happy to mention that Lost was featured as a great read in People magazine a couple weeks ago. That, of course, was a huge, huge shock, but and just wonderful. But what pleased me even more was that the little blurb compared, in some sense, Lost to Russell Banks' Affliction, which is one of my favorite contemporary novels. And I really haven't read that novel for about 20 years of it, but I do, when I think of Affliction, I think about it in many ways, but one of the things I retained was Russell Banks' just extraordinary description of the winter, and his, I think, is set in the Adirondacks, where he lives, but of an Adirondack winter day or weekend, or I can't quite remember the time frame, but something like that. So I love the fact that winter came through so strongly for you.
Oh, no, it did. Now, I've not read Affliction, so I don't know.
Well, you've got to.
But
not that you don't have enough things to read.
No, and I've loved Russell Banks. You know, I've read a lot of his books. Just it's that one in particular I never read.
It's an early one.
But he's a terrific writer.
He is a great writer.
Now, that's just, you know, while we still have a little time, maybe you could talk a little bit about your influences. Who, as a writer, or which writers, do you feel strongly have influenced your, not necessarily the writing itself, but your way of being a writer, the things you think about?
Oh, well, I love that question. I love the way you put that question, because so often it's put as just, who are your top five writers, you know, which immediately puts me into a complete mental block. I can tell you, one of the novels that I feel has really enormously influenced me was Henry Roth, not to be confused with Philip. Henry Ross call it sleep.
Oh, yeah.
Which is gave me permission on some level as a writer to inhabit the interior of a character, the psychological interior of a character, in a way that I think I wouldn't have known how to do. I mean, I don't think I do exactly what he does technically, but by any means. But again, that sort of, oh wow, you're allowed to do that. You know, I often have that feeling when I've read something that just that really I know is going to be an influence. And that certainly had that experience there. Similarly, I would say that James Agee's A Death in the Family, which also uses a very close interior third-person point of view, and of course has that just extraordinarily gorgeous lyricism. And the connection that both of those writers have to, it sounds strange, but to have to the damaged boy is somehow very important to me. I don't know why this is. I am not a damaged boy, nor, you know, but I feel this extraordinary connection to boys who are not fitting in quite perfectly to the world. And I guess, I say boys, so that's Corey, but I guess anyone who isn't fitting into the world quite so easily. As Susan doesn't quite fit in herself, Jeff certainly.
Right, all of the characters.
Doesn't,
well,
you know,
yeah, I think all the characters in this novel.
So, you know, there's this deep kinship of writers with writers who are examining the complex inner life of the outsider. I guess that's a way of putting it. And then another book I have to mention, if you have time, is Shirley, and now this, I've never known how to pronounce her last name. It's either Shirley Hazard or Shirley Hazard, and, you know, I'd love to know, but let's call her Shirley Hazard for lack of a better pronunciation.
Yeah.
Her Transit of Venus was a book, and again, I haven't actually sat down and read it for probably 15 years, but it was also a book that combined for me both a prose that just, you know, kind of blew my ears off, so beautiful, and a psychological perception, interior perception that was very important to me. But then, I'll just add this because I've only come to see this recently with this book. My first novel, The Genius of the World, probably owes more directly to those three books. Lost, I have to say that I did make a conscious decision to let go a little bit of my lyrical line, although I'm very happy to say people have said that they love the writing and so on. It's been very wonderful to hear because in my mind I kind of loosened things up and I decided that there was nothing wrong with having a book that actually that had a narrative pace that you actually pulled you in and you wanted to keep reading. You know, my stated goal before Lost was to write a book that no one could possibly finish in one night. I mean, I wanted it to take, you know, a month, because I like reading books very slowly myself. But then I realized that I was enjoying books that I really was just completely pulled into and couldn't put down. So I thought, hey, you know, that's okay. You can do that. You can try that. You know.
Well,
and along those lines, I would point to actually writers like Graham Greene. Brighton Rock is one of my absolute favorite novels, and the pacing is unreal, and it's just one of the most intense books I think ever written. You know, it's just your hair is standing on end just about the entire book. So, you know, I'm open to new influences.
Well, you've named some really good ones, and you've given me some ideas. Although I read books by living authors, so
yeah,
I may have limited.
And bless you for that, you know.
But
they're already famous. What, they don't need our help.
But I think you've written a book that meets your own criterion of being a book that you can, you know, this that just grabs you and takes you all the way through.
Oh, thank you.
I want to thank you for talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Alice Lichtenstein, whose new book, Lost, a novel, I would highly recommend. Thank you so much, Alice.
Oh, thank you, David.